Support for this podcast comes from Wise, one account for over 50 currencies. Whether you're sending pesos to your parents, receiving dollars from a friend, or spending in euros, you can do it all from your Wise account. You always get the real exchange rate with no markups and no hidden fees, helping you save on currency conversion wherever your money takes you. Join 13 million people and businesses who are already saving. Learn more about how Wise could work for you at wise.com/world.
China follows threats with action, sending warships through the Strait of Taiwan. Not a big surprise.
However, the way in which China has chosen to display that force, I think, is unprecedented.
I'm Marco Werman. Also today, inflation is crushing Argentina. Young people there were already struggling to live on their own, and now rising prices are pushing many of them to leave.
Most of my friends had already moved abroad, mainly to Spain and some of them to U.S.
Plus, the world's fastest animal, the cheetah, was hunted to extinction in India. After 7 decades, the big cats are coming back.
Now we have the economic ability, the threats to the extinction have been exterminated, and the scientific know-how to bring back the lost element of our ecosystem and our lost heritage.
Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Thanks for making it here. In Moscow today, a verdict for women's basketball star Brittany Griner. She was sentenced to 9 years in prison on drug charges. Griner was detained at a Moscow airport back in February after security officials found vape cartridges with cannabis oil in her luggage. Last month, Griner pleaded guilty to possessing the drugs, but said she packed them by mistake. The U.S. government called Griner's sentence today a miscarriage of justice. The World's Daniel Offman has the latest.
31-year-old Brittany Griner's trial began just over a month ago. Here's part of her closing statement, which she delivered before her sentence was handed down.
I understand everything that's been said against me, the charges that are against me, and that is why I pled guilty. But I had no intent to break any Russian law.
As she spoke, an interpreter delivered her message before the judge in Russian. Griner was standing behind the bars of a cage inside the courtroom.
I know everybody keeps talking about political pawn and politics, but I hope that that is far from this courtroom.
U.S. officials say Griner was wrongfully detained in Russia. They say they've been working tirelessly to bring her home, and they've offered a significant proposal for her release and the release of another American in Russian detention, Paul Whelan. Here's Secretary of State Antony Blinken speaking last week.
The significant proposal that's been on the tables for some weeks now that would lead to bringing home Paul Whelan and Brittany Griner. I urged Foreign Minister Lavrov to move forward with that proposal. I'm not going to characterize his response, and I can't give you an assessment of whether I think things are any more or less likely, but it was important that he hear directly from me on that.
News reports say that the Biden administration is considering a prisoner swap, in which the Russian government would release both Brittany Griner and former U.S. Marine Paul Whelan in exchange for the release of Russian arms dealer Victor Boot.
Victor Boot, he has the moniker, the Merchant of Death.
Kimberly St. Julian Varnin is a PhD candidate at the University of Pennsylvania and an expert on Russian history. She's been following Griner's case closely.
He was convicted for arms dealing, including dealing arms to FARC in Colombia. So he has a 25-year sentence. He served 10 years of that in federal prison. His lawyers have been pushing for a swap. The Russian state's been interested in him since he was arrested. So I think that's an important part of this.
But a swap could be difficult to achieve, partly because of how high profile the Griner case has become. Here's St. Julian Varnin again.
The Biden administration could have less wiggle room in terms of negotiating with Russia because Russia knows how much public pressure is on Joe Biden to get Brittany Griner out. And Russia's always had all the cards in this situation, but now Russia understands that Biden will respond to public pressure from the United States.
And that means Russian officials will be likely to drive a hard bargain, especially since relations between the U.S. and Russia are so bad right now.
If Russia makes more demands and they want more people out of American federal prisons, they have leverage now to do so.
Now that Brittany Griner has been sentenced in Moscow, negotiations for any possible prisoner swap can begin.
This is standard for the Russian criminal justice system in general, but particularly towards Americans who've been detained and convicted in Russia. Now that there's a conviction, this step is done, and now we're on to the significant conversation about negotiations, who will be swapped for whom, and a timeline for that to happen.
U.S. officials say that former Marine Paul Whelan was also wrongfully convicted. He's served more than 3 years in prison on what are widely believed to be trumped-up charges. Outside the courthouse today, Elizabeth Rood delivered a statement to the press. She's the deputy chief of mission at the U.S. Embassy in Moscow.
Secretary of State Blinken, President Biden's national security team, and the entire American government remain committed to bringing Ms. Greiner home safely to her family, friends, and loved ones.
Until then, Brittany Griner will likely start serving her 9-year sentence at a Russian prison colony as her friends, family, and fans wait for a deal that would set her free. For The World, I'm Daniel Hoffman.
The seas around the island nation of Taiwan are filled with Chinese warships today. China's government in Beijing ordered these war games. It's a response to House Speaker Nancy Pelosi's visit earlier this week. Taiwan, as you know, is a self-governed democracy, and they buy lots of U.S. military hardware. But Beijing considers Taiwan to be part of China. Taiwan's government says China, by conducting these war games, it's tantamount to a naval blockade. The world's Southeast Asia correspondent Patrick Nguyen joins us. Patrick, describe what's going on right now with these military maneuvers.
Well, it certainly looks like a blockade, Marco. You've got Chinese warships surrounding the island, fighter jets in the air. They are firing live rounds. They are shooting within some cases 10 miles from the coast. This is all unprecedented. As for whether or not it's a real blockade, I would put it this way. Commercial flights have been landing all day long, although many flights are canceled. Cargo ships are coming and going, and they're just going around the warships, which are in fixed locations. And China isn't using force to stop any of this traffic. So it's not really a blockade, even though Taiwan's government is calling it that. But it could become one instantly if Beijing were to make that decision.
So what is China trying to accomplish with all this?
Well, China says this is pure self-defense. It considers Taiwan part of its territory. They say Pelosi was, quote, manic and irresponsible for coming to Taiwan and colluding with a secessionist government. And basically, they want to show that if any other high-level American officials keep coming to Taiwan and giving support to that government, that Taiwan will suffer. But it's also a really great opportunity for China to simulate many of the maneuvers that it would need to pull off for a real invasion or a real blockade. And that's not just speculation. This is all being said openly in Chinese state media. And I think, Marco, it will also provide really valuable intelligence because China will get to see how America's military is going to react.
Mm. Well, the U.S. policy toward Taiwan is intentionally ambiguous about whether or not the American military would intervene in a conflict there. But President Biden has said that the U.S. would help defend Taiwan. So how are the U.S. and Taiwanese militaries responding so far to these actions, these war games by Beijing?
Well, as for the U.S., American warships, including an aircraft carrier, are in the neighborhood. They're hanging back in different locations, most about 500 or 600 miles away from Taiwan. Taiwan, of course, has its own military, which is heavily armed by the U.S., and honestly, U.S. defense corporations do make a ton of money selling weapons to Taiwan. So far, the Taiwanese forces aren't really challenging China's encirclement because, I mean, very bluntly, China's military could cream Taiwan's military, no contest. China now has the world's largest navy, and in the most recent and most sophisticated U.S. war games that simulate what would happen if America tried to stop a Chinese invasion of Taiwan, America, quote, failed miserably, and that's according to the Pentagon. So China may have the upper hand here.
Patrick, do you have a sense of how people in China see their government's approach to Taiwan, especially with this latest unprecedented round of war games? I mean, does it make them nervous or proud?
All we can really see is what's in Chinese state media, which is in a very chest-thumping mode right now. This is a huge domestic story in China. It's being covered as China finally standing up, not so much to Taiwan, but to the United States. And if I can quote a tweet from one of the officials at China's Ministry of Foreign Affairs, power is the only language that the U.S. apparently understands, and that's why they've had to encircle Taiwan.
The World's Patrick Nguyen, following the story in the South China Sea, the tension between China and Taiwan and the U.S. Patrick, thanks as always.
Thanks, Marco.
For more on China's military escalation and where all this could lead, we turn now to Taylor Fravel. He directs MIT's Security Studies Program and focuses his studies on China. Taylor, what is your reaction to China's military response? Was it predictable? Any surprises here?
So on the one hand, I'm not surprised that China responded to Speaker Pelosi's visit with a significant display of military force. However, the way in which China has chosen to display that force, I think, is unprecedented. Currently, they are undertaking exercises which effectively encircle Taiwan. It is still, I think, important to note that it's a demonstration or show of force. It's not an actual use of force against Taiwan or any other actor in the area.
So China's military has announced this aggressive war games operation will go on for 2 days. Do you think they show their might, then go back to China? Or now that Beijing has shown its hand, does the escalation continue?
It's hard to say what will happen next. In part, it depends upon how other countries respond. I think this phase will end certainly by the 7th of August, which is when the notification for the closure areas expire. But I don't think these are the last military exercises we're going to see near Taiwan. And I think in the course of holding these exercises, China's military has broken several of the norms that were previously quite strong in the region. One was not to cross the median line with aircraft that basically separates Taiwan from the coast of mainland China. I think we will now see Chinese aircraft routinely flying across the median line, and that could go on for some time.
Short of a full-on confrontation, and certainly let's hope not, World War III, what is the scenario that worries you the most right now?
Well, the scenario that worries me the most in the very short term is that there could be some kind of accident or miscalculation in the course of these exercises that results in escalation. And principally, this could occur by inadvertently striking either Taiwanese or American military assets that are in the area.
Taylor, there have been tensions in the Taiwan Strait before, but have you ever seen it this fraught or worrisome?
We've never seen exercises on this scope and scale before. The last time we had really significant exercises targeting Taiwan approaching the scale would have been in sort of summer and fall of 95 and the spring of 1996. And so in this sense, I think that there are probably moments, I think, when Chen Shui-bian was president of Taiwan, that tensions were perhaps even higher, but there wasn't necessarily the military component that we're observing now. But I think tensions are high and they're likely to remain high because all sides are locked into positions from which they're unlikely to change.
China's military is putting on a powerful display of force in the Taiwan Strait with these war games and military maneuvers. But if you're a Chinese general, you must also know that the end game here could be a confrontation with the U.S. military. What do you know about how the upper ranks of the People's Liberation Army see all this and their appetite for an engagement with the U.S. and possibly its allies?
Clearly, there's an appreciation of the potential destructiveness of conflict, especially a high-intensity conflict that would involve the United States and Chinese armed forces. The Chinese military leadership, although they might sound as if they are quite confident, I'm not sure how confident they really would be, given the complexity of the operations they would need to undertake. And if the United States were to become involved, the nature of the opponent, right, which is the most powerful military in the world, even if not all of its forces are going to be are in the Asian region. Nevertheless, the U.S. is quite capable and always been the benchmark against which the Chinese military has assessed its own progress.
So taking the hopeful view, do you think the U.S. and China can work together to lower the temperature over Taiwan? I mean, what would that take?
Some people call this, the fourth Taiwan Strait crisis or the start of one. But I think we're in a moment in which the U.S. and China, if they work in parallel, but with the same goal of reducing the potential for unwanted escalation, might find themselves perhaps down the road in a somewhat more stable position. Because sometimes it takes a crisis or near crisis to realize just how dangerous a situation might be, and then what would be needed to avoid really damaging escalation. Both countries are nuclear powers, and China is in the process of a very significant expansion and modernization of its nuclear forces. It would not just be a conflict that would occur, would be between two large militaries, but between two large nuclear armed militaries. And that, on the face of it, is a frightening prospect.
Taylor Fravel is an expert on China's military. He's a director of the MIT Security Studies Program. Taylor, thanks so much for helping us understand where these tensions could go.
Thanks so much for having me.
We head to Iran next and the sounds of protest music that have filled the summer there. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We've been exploring chart-topping music from across the globe this summer. Our next story in that series comes to us from the south of Iran, an area on the Persian Gulf where musicians tap into influences from a variety of sources: India, Yemen, the Horn of Africa, and this summer something else is shaping music from southern Iran: politics. The World's Duri Buscarin reports.
For many Iranians, summer means parties until the early morning, driving at night with the windows down, and something like this in the background. The Slipped Poem by the Syria Ensemble. In your eyes, he sings.
This is just shot.
And then he coughs, apologizing for forgetting his lines. And so he continues, singing about his lover and tripping over his words. The Syria Ensemble, from the coastal Iranian city of Bushehr, is part of a growing interest in Persian music, with roots in the south.
It always carries a sense of happiness. It's an invitation to move. So cheerful.
Sara is a 29-year-old teacher from the city of Awaz. She asked not to use her full name because she's employed by the government. She says music from the south makes you feel something, both when it's happy and when it's sad.
No matter where I am and what mood I'm in, if I hear southern music, I burst into tears automatically.
This summer, there were reasons for tears. On May 23rd, a shopping mall in the city of Abadan collapsed, killing more than 40 people. The cause of the collapse was the ongoing illegal construction of several floors above the mall. People faulted the government for turning a blind eye to corrupt builders and protested in the streets.
It went viral. It became like a symbol.
This musician, based in southern Iran, asked to remain anonymous due to the risk of criticizing the government. He says his Instagram feed was filled with videos of the collapse and artists paying tribute to the victims with music from the south.
I mean, some people being killed is something, but some people being killed because of someone else's fault and someone else's corruption and all, that is what makes it even sadder, you know, and makes people more angry.
In a political system that often doesn't listen to the complaints of everyday people, he says, this anger doesn't have anywhere to go.
It's a fire under ashes, no? It's something that you don't see it right now, but it's still there.
So people have been channeling their anger through music. In this video, a woman performs alone at a piano, with a photograph of two victims in the background. In another, an ensemble called Ulurian dedicates this song to the grieving people of Abadan. When you hear this music, you feel empathy and solidarity, says Farhoush, an Instagram influencer who also asked not to use her full name. They're full of these burning sensations of sadness, she says. Homemade videos, many with information about the victims and messages of support, show a community processing sorrow, not just for the victims of this disaster, but for the political system that allowed it to happen. It felt like this place is cursed, said Issa Zara'i. We keep falling from one catastrophe to another. Zara'i is a self-taught musician from southern Iran who specializes in the tar, a mainstay of Iranian classical music. Everything since the Iran-Iraq war, he says, rampant pollution, the water crisis, the political crisis. If you consider all of that, he says, what happened in Abadan isn't surprising. In the south, Zara'i says, music is an inseparable part of daily life. We live with it, work alongside it, he says. It keeps changing, being made and adapted by the people who love it. Like this piece, which he composed himself. To Zara'i, playing music is a rebellion against pain. For the world, I'm Duri Buscarin in Istanbul.
This story was co-reported with Seema Gadirzadeh. In the upper left corner of the Australian flag, you'll find the British Union Jack. The Queen of England is also Australia's monarch and pays regular visits.
Although the other visitors from England were drawing the crowds at Melbourne Cricket Ground, thousands of Australians turned out to greet the royal couple.
That's from a visit to Victoria State by Queen Elizabeth and Prince Philip back in 1977.
Melbourne's police horses, a little unused to the strict demands of royal pageantry, lead the Queen into the city centre, and the biggest welcome of her overseas tour.
Victoria resident Lydia Thorpe was just 4 years old when the Queen came to visit her town. Thorpe is an Indigenous Australian with Jabiru'ong Gunai and Gunditjmara heritage. Her grandmother was an Indigenous rights activist, so was her mom. Lydia Thorpe herself is a member of Australia's Green Party. She was appointed as a senator from Victoria to Australia's Parliament back in 2020. She retained the post when she was elected this past May. On Monday, after some delays, things became official.
We'll now move to the swearing-in of a senator, Senator Thorpe, to be sworn as the senator for Victoria.
Thorpe strode confidently into the chambers with her fist raised in a Black Power salute. Like her mother and grandmother before her, Thorpe champions the rights of Indigenous people. That may have informed what Senator Thorpe said next during her swearing in.
I, Sovereign Lydia Thorpe, do solemnly and sincerely affirm and declare that I will be faithful and I bear true allegiance to the colonising Her Majesty Queen Elizabeth II.
Senator Thorpe.
To the colonizing Her Majesty Queen Elizabeth II. A moment later, Thorpe gave the oath a second reading. This time she swore her allegiance to the crown, verbatim, as required by law. But she had made her point. Australia was a British colony for more than 100 years, during which time thousands of Aboriginal Australians were killed and communities were displaced wholesale. Lydia Thorpe carries that history with her into office. In June, she told Australia's Channel 10 why she ran for Parliament and what she hopes to accomplish there.
I wanted to contribute to renewing this nation. And renewing this nation means that everybody in this country should know whose land they're on. They should understand the stories that are associated with that land. I don't want people to get upset by what I have to say. I want people to come on a learning journey and a truth-telling journey so that we can unite this country and mature as a nation.
Senator from Victoria, Australia, Lydia Thorpe, a voice for Aboriginal rights in Parliament in her country. More stories from around the globe coming up in the second half of the show. You're listening to The World. A new exhibition about our polarized world and ideas to bring us together, achieving peace through architecture, food, videos, and this game where you are an immigration official.
And your only job is to look at people's documentation and decide if they should be allowed into your country or turned away.
It's an eye-opener, Designing Peace, that's coming up here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. Voters in Kenya are gearing up for their presidential election early next week. The incumbent, Uhuru Kenyatta, is concluding his second and final term. The campaign to replace him has been heated. Top of mind for most ordinary Kenyans is the economy and the basic ability to put food on the table. From Nairobi, The World's Africa correspondent Halima Gikandi has more.
On the dusty grounds of a school in Kenya's Kiambu County, outside of the capital, young people sit on top of campaign vans next to stereos blasting campaign music. Hundreds of people have gathered here for one last political rally before the vote next Tuesday. Their cheers are for presidential candidate William Ruto. He is Kenya's current deputy president, so he is no newbie to politics, but he has cast himself as a political outsider, a person from humble roots and a champion for the common Kenyan. His slogan has been Hustler Nation. The message resonates with a lot of Kenyans fed up with political elites, people like Judy Wangari, who sells mobile phone credit.
Unga. Fertilizer,
We have a lot of problems, she tells me. The prices of everything have gone way up. Especially unga, she says. That's a type of flour made out of maize or corn. It's used to make ugali, a common dish in Kenya that's a little like polenta or grits. Timothy Njagi is an agricultural development expert with the Tegemeo Institute in Nairobi.
This year, the price of food has really gone up, especially compared to last year. For some commodities, the prices have actually more than doubled. And these are key staples that people tend to use very often.
He tells me the ongoing drought in the region, the impact of COVID and the war in Ukraine on imports, they've all compounded the problem of high food prices in Kenya. The price of unga, the flour made out of maize, has gotten special national attention. Njagi tells me why.
And maize is a key staple, actually, for Kenyans. And when you don't have maize, people usually, it's synonymous with no food being available.
Njagi tells me the price of unga has risen more than 100% over the past year. Many Kenyans can simply not afford it now. Last month, the outgoing government announced it would subsidize unga and called for a bag of maize flour to be sold at half the price, 100 shillings, which is less than a dollar.
So immediately the subsidy was announced, people are rushing to buy as much as they could buy, partly because, of course, the communication was not very clear. People were saying that, oh, this is going to be for 4 weeks only. So people were kind of stocking up.
That led to reports of unga shortages across the country. The issue was quickly politicized. Local media are calling it unga politics because some saw it as a boost for presidential candidate Raila Odinga. He's got the support of the current outgoing president. That's who Mary Akoth supports. She runs a food stand in Nairobi. At lunchtime, she sells cooked vegetables, meat, with, of course, a side of ugali. I meet her as she's pouring the maize flour into a big pot of water. And I ask her how this new unga subsidy is working out, if she's able to buy it for 100 shillings. You can't find it at that price, she says. Instead, she buys bags of maize flour at twice the cost. I ask Akoth if she's had to raise her prices. No, she says, if you raise the price of food, people won't buy it. So she deals with it and keeps cooking. Akoth tells me she hopes the new government will fix these problems. I asked Timothy Njagi, the agricultural development expert, what it would take to bring down food prices.
The first one and the most important one is that we have to grow productivity. Essentially, that means you have to be able to produce more with less.
That will mean Kenya investing more in research and technology in agriculture. Subsidies that come during an election season, he tells me, that's just a band-aid. For The World, I'm Halima Gikandi in Nairobi.
Inflation is on a lot of people's minds right now. Bought coffee or milk lately? Yeah, you can't help but think about it. But we Americans are not seeing the worst of it, not by a long shot. Argentina, for example, people there are expecting to see 100% inflation by the end of this year. In other words, Argentines could soon be paying double what they had once spent on, say, milk. As to how the government in Argentina is taking this on, it just named its third economic minister in less than a month, and he's declared the creation of a super ministry to deal with the crisis. The World's TBC Isaiah reports.
Argentinians are used to dealing with inflation, but not like this.
Es una inflación mayor a lo normal. Y mira, yo tengo 39 años.
Me parece Emilio Garofalo owns a meat and cheese shop in the capital, Buenos Aires. He's 39 and he says he doesn't remember another time in his life when inflation was so high.
Bueno, claramente lo que más afecta es no conocer el precio de las cosas.
He says nobody knows what anything is worth because prices change every week. Salaries don't keep up with inflation, so everyone feels like they are getting poorer. Garofalo says he's changing the inventory at his shop, figuring out how to make a profit in these tough times. At the national level, Argentina's new economy minister is doing the same. He started the job yesterday.
No soy super nada, ni mago, ni Salvador.
I'm not a magician, Sergio Massa said last night. I'm not a savior, but I'm committed to fighting inflation. Here is some of what the minister is dealing with. Argentina's currency, the peso, is dropping in value. The country defaulted on its national debt in 2020, and it's cut off from international borrowing. The government has been printing money, but that has made inflation worse. Sergio Massa, the new economy minister, says he'll stop printing money, boost exports, reduce the deficit, and increase cash reserves. But he's not providing many details about how he'll accomplish all of that. Ignacio Lavacchi is a professor of economics at the Catholic University of Argentina. He says there is a lot that needs to be done.
So a stabilization plan requires clearly a serious fiscal adjustment, a drastic hike in interest rates, and also a devaluation. I don't think the government has the political power to conduct such a stabilization plan.
He says these measures are politically unpopular because they would mean more economic pain for the public, and a lot of the people are already feeling it.
The situation in Argentina is getting worse day by day.
I spoke with Flor Giovinazzo, a marketing professional who works for a consulting firm in Buenos Aires.
Even though I am a good performer, I continue growing my career here. We have salary adjustments every other month, but still my salary is very, very affected.
She says she started working for the company 15 years ago. At that time, her salary was about $1,800 a month. Now she's a manager, but her pay is only worth about $800.
It's very difficult for young people to be able to live on their own. Most of my friends have already moved abroad, mainly to Spain and some of them to US.
Giovinazzo says she's also thinking about leaving, because she has lost hope in the government to fix this economic crisis. Estela Cornare is a taxi driver in Buenos Aires.
Yo soy grande y he vivido muchas inflaciones.
She says she still has faith in the government to solve the inflation problem, but she's also very concerned for older people in Argentina.
Sí, es preocupante la situación de los pensionados.
Her pension, about $150 a month, isn't enough to live on. So she's still out on the road driving her taxi 5 days a week.
Estamos haciendo entre 7 y 8 mil pesos. Es muy inestable porque...
Cornales says she makes about $25 a day, but because of inflation, people are not using taxis as much as they used to. She says she's worried because she's 77 years old and can't imagine working full-time for another 10 years. For the world, I'm Tibisay Sea.
In another part of the globe, in the southeast part of Africa, Zimbabwe's inflation was soaring at 192% in June. Some Zimbabweans now have to make the harsh choice between bread or transportation. The oversupply of local currency and its rapid devaluation are driving that inflation. Now the government has launched a gold coin in hopes of dealing with the situation. That story and more reporting on the global economy are on our website, theworld.org. I'm not the only one. You must feel it too. Like, the globe is out of control. Wars in Ukraine and Syria, nail-biting tensions with China, dozens of insurgent groups in Congo, not to mention jihadist movements in West Africa. Divisions everywhere, it seems. Just taking a few minutes to even ponder peace, that can be restorative and instructive. A new peace exhibition in New York City provides that space. The World's Sarah Birnbaum went to check it out.
When Cynthia Smith began this project, she had one question in mind.
What if we could design for peace?
Smith is the curator for socially responsible design at the Cooper Hewitt Smithsonian Design Museum. After the murder of Trayvon Martin and a spate of other racial killings, Smith traveled across the U.S. speaking to artists who were trying to address racial conflict and inequality in creative and constructive ways. She came away wondering what this kind of work looks like on a global scale.
And so what you're seeing here, we're in, sitting in the center of the exhibition, are 40 creative and design responses from all over the world.
24 countries, to be exact. Smith took me on a tour of the exhibition. There are installations, photos, films, architectural models, and even video games. Like Papers, Please, with its 1980s Soviet-style graphics and this plodding anthem that will stay in your head for days. The Papers, Please video game flips gaming convention on its head. Instead of players taking on the persona of an international spy, this game puts players in the role of a low-level border agent.
Papers, Please is a game about checking passports. You work at a border checkpoint. and your only job is to look at people's documentation and decide if they should be allowed into your country or turned away.
This is Japan-based designer Lucas Pope.
Games are basically the perfect medium to understand other characters' positions or complex issues like this. I do hope that people can play the game and sort of turn immigration from a simple yes or no into something a lot more considered and thoughtful.
The point is to build empathy and confront the stark realities of immigration policy at the same time. Another project that tries to build empathy is Conflict Kitchen, and it does it through food, my favorite medium. Conflict Kitchen was a pop-up takeout restaurant in Pittsburgh, which served food from nations the U.S. was in conflict with. The restaurant would rotate the menu depending on what was going on in the world. So one week, it might serve food from Cuba. Another week, food from Afghanistan. There's a replica of the Iranian iteration of the restaurant right here in the museum. The facade is blue and yellow with a Persian tile pattern. And on the opposite wall, there's a TV screen where you can watch old news reports about the project.
So you order Iranian food or Persian food, anywhere from $5 to $8, and they give it to you wrapped up in a wrapper that has conversations from people that are in that country.
From the Conflict Kitchen, curator Cynthia Smith walks me past a reproduction of the Mexico-U.S. border wall and over to a section of the gallery that's separated by blue paper streamers. Everything here is blue. Blue walls, blue floor, a large blue wall map which shows the hundreds of UN peacekeeping compounds all over sub-Saharan Africa. Smith tells me the blue color scheme is a nod to UN peacekeepers who wear blue helmets and the local tribes of the Sahel who use indigo to dye their clothes. She brings my attention to a table of architectural models which show how UN peace missions could be designed better.
And so what you're looking at here are four different models.
These models are the work of Israeli architect Malkit Shoshan. Shoshan tells me the first time she saw a UN peacekeeping mission was on a trip to Kosovo in 2007, and she says she was shocked.
There were military compounds, logistic hubs, walls, barbed wires. I mean, these elements of, you can say, war were used to kind of stabilize the situation there and bring peace, but it felt so incredibly, not just violent, but prominent.
Shoshan's designs for UN bases use local materials and local building techniques, and you can see that in the models. Instead of walls and divisions, there's a sense of seamlessness and continuity.
I think that the way that we think of spaces, the way that we conceptualize the access to spaces, who has access, who can be seen, heard, contributes a lot towards the possibility of justice.
This is Dutch artist Jonas Stahl. His design for a new kind of parliament building is on display at Designing Peace. Stahl was approached in 2011 by a Kurdish activist with the self-appointed government in Rojava in northern Syria. She wanted a parliament building that would embody the ideals of the Kurdish liberation movement, which, in the words of the movement, are feminism, socialism, and anarchism. Stahl came up with a circular meeting space that's partly enclosed by steel arches and a fragmented dome. The dome is composed of overlapping flags, the flags of all the organizations that govern the region, and all of them have images of stars and suns.
If you stand in the parliament and you look above, you see parts of the sky through the beams of the parliament, and you are surrounded by these visual symbols of stars and suns, and as such, it creates a kind of ideological planetarium.
In the exhibit, you can see a time-lapse video of the building going up. You see the metal arches rising from the desert, and artisans painting the flags for the ceiling. You also hear from Amina Asa, the activist who commissioned the parliament from Stahl. She says, "This parliament behind me is important because it allows all the people of Rojava to come together under one roof, to share power and live together. The parliament represents all of society, everyone." The world today is in conflict, that's for sure. But the overarching message of this exhibition is the root causes of war, like racism and inequality, are products of design. and so they can be redesigned. Curator Cynthia Smith.
One of the primary points that we want to have visitors walk away with is that they have agency in their own, in creating peace in their own communities.
She says everyone has a crucial role to play. For The World, I'm Sarah Birnbaum in New York.
Something extraordinary is being attempted in India, the reintroduction of the cheetah, an animal that was declared extinct on the subcontinent back in 1952. 16 cheetahs from South Africa and Namibia are being prepared for their journey to India next week. This is the first time a large carnivore is being moved from one continent to another for reintroduction to the wild. Yadvendradev Jala is playing a key role in this effort. He's dean of the Wildlife Institute of India and joins us from Dehradun, a town in the Himalayas. So, Jala, the cheetah was declared extinct in India 70 years ago, as I said. What is behind the decision to reintroduce it?
I think the world needs to restore its lost fauna and flora, especially those which have been caused by human actions. The cheetah was hunted out to extinction in India. And now we have the economic ability, the threats to the extinction have been exterminated, and the scientific know-how to bring back the lost element of our ecosystem and our lost heritage. So it is right time to bring the animal back to India.
So the cheetahs that are going to be taken to India are from Namibia and South Africa. How similar are they to the cheetahs that used to be in India?
Well, we have just one species of cheetah across the world. The subspecies which was found in India, there are only less than about 15 to 20 individuals left in Iran. And it's not possible to bring back that subspecies because the population is extremely endangered, highly inbred, and you can't do a reintroduction project with 15 individuals. So the only population which has surplus cheetah to give for a reintroduction project is in southern Africa, Namibia, South Africa, and Botswana, where the cheetah population is close to about 4,000 individuals. So we need a continuous supply to establish a viable population in India, anywhere between 35 to 50 individuals over the period of next 5 years. And this is the only population which can sustain that kind of offtake. Also, it has good genetic diversity and the right kind of individuals which know how to hunt and can live off the prey in a free-ranging condition in India.
Right, and you said that some of the India subspecies, or the subspecies that used to live in India, some live in Iran, but apparently they're very few there, right?
Absolutely, less than 15 individuals.
Wow. So what will these cheetahs from Namibia and South Africa find familiar, and what will be unfamiliar to them in India compared to where they came from?
Most large carnivores look for shelter, protection, and food. All that is available in India. The climatic conditions are very similar. The cheetah are extremely adaptable species. They live in varied habitats, even in southern Africa. So you get them in forested ecosystems, within snow, within arid regions, in the grasslands. So we have all these varied habitats available in India. We have deer in place of antelope as the major prey. And I don't anticipate any problems of cheetah hunting the spotted deer in place of the impala.
So the cheetah can reach top running speeds of 75 miles an hour. That makes it the fastest land animal on the planet. Are there any predators that might go after the cheetah?
Well, not at that speed for sure. But yes, the cheetah is known to be at the bottom rung of the carnivore pyramid of dominance. And we would have tigers, lions, and leopards, which would dominate cheetah. Fortunately, the first park where we're going to put the animals, there are no tigers and no lions. There are leopards there. But cheetah coped with all these predators in Africa, and they coped in ancient times, just 100 years ago, with these predators in India as well. So they are a master artist at escape.
So how do you actually select and prepare the cheetahs from southern Africa for reintroduction to Asia?
So what we look for are animals which are behaviorally able to hunt for themselves, are not very afraid of humans in the sense they don't approach human beings, but they allow a vehicle or a human being to approach within, you know, maybe about 50 meters. So that if we want to manage those animals, if they move out of our protected area, we would need to capture them and bring them back. In India, we don't have fences on our parks. These animals could potentially move out of the national park into human landscapes. And of course, we also look at genetic variability. The southern African animals, the cheetah, are extremely genetically diverse. So we're going to mix the gene pool of Namibia and southern Africa, South Africa, to start a population of our own, which would be genetically very vibrant.
So, Jala, the big question, how do you actually get cheetahs to India from southern Africa? I mean, is it as simple as putting them in a cage on a plane?
Absolutely. Currently, the animals which we have selected for the translocation are in quarantine at the cheetah conservation facility and two or three different places, southern Africa. And They've been screened for diseases, vaccinated, and they are ready to be crated. They're already equipped with radio collars. Wow. And we'll put them in crates and airlift them to India.
How are they doing? Do they have any sense of what's going on?
No, not at all. It's going to be fun when they are released here because it's a whole new ecosystem for them. They're going to have fun hunting because these prey, I don't know, they've not had cheetah around with them for 100 years. They're going to be surprised with what's going to hit them.
Presumably, you must have been kind of face to face with a cheetah before. What are they like up close?
They are totally non-aggressive. I have been very close to a wild cheetah on foot. And I was amazed. I worked with lions and tigers in my country, and I've been walking with these animals as well. But with cheetah, you can take a lot of liberties. They are such placid, wonderful animals. You approach close by and you reach their personal space, and they'll, you know, just smack the ground with their paws and say, okay, that's the distance you want to keep from them. They're really noble animals, very non-aggressive, but maintaining their personal space. There's not been a single record of a wild cheetah attacking a human being.
Interesting.
So it's one animal you want to have in your neighborhood. If you want to have a large carnivore, it's the cheetah.
I'm taking note and living in a neighborhood of coyotes right now. So Jala, how long will it take to figure out whether the reintroduction of the cheetah in India is working?
There are several criteria of judging success. First of all, it's when the cheetahs are actually released and they go out and explore and establish their own territories. The next step would be when the females actually come into estrus and breed with the males that have established. Third would be when the litters are born in the wild and they survive. Ultimate success would be when you have a viable population established in India. And we don't expect that to happen unless it's aided by human beings. A population for a cheetah to be viable would need to have at least 35 to 40 mature individuals. Mm. And for that, we would need to move animals around between 4 to 5 populations that we are planning to establish in India. So it will be an artificially managed metapopulation to ensure that the demography of these animals is viable, as well as the genetics of this population is viable. And actually what we plan to do is we're extending the global range of the cheetah. The cheetah has been dwindling and across all the range countries. So by putting it back in India, we hope to claim a lot of that space which was lost and manage the Indian population along with the Southern African population. So we can exchange individuals across the continents for years to come, provide genetic supply from India back to Namibia and to Southern Africa, and keep moving cheetahs between these continents so that the animals remain genetically vibrant for posterity.
You must be pretty excited by this whole endeavor.
It's like a life's ambition come true, you know.
Yadvendradev Jala is the dean of the Wildlife Institute of India and is playing a key role in the reintroduction of the cheetah to the country. He joined us from Dehradun in the Himalayas. Jala, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much for giving me this opportunity.
The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio in Boston and the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. I'm Marco Werman. Be safe. Stay strong. Thank you for listening.